Good evening from the White House in Washington. The National Broadcasting Company brings you an address by the President of the United States. The Secretary of Agriculture, Henry Wallace, will also speak from here. And from New York, Postmaster General James A. Farley will be heard. Tonight, hundreds of thousands of farmers are attending farm dinners in 28 states. The occasion is the 7th anniversary of President Roosevelt's call for a national meeting of farm leaders to consider ways and means of dealing with the farm problem. We hear first tonight from Secretary of Agriculture Wallace, who participated with the President in arranging the first conference and who has been responsible for administering the National Farm Program authorized by the Congress during the past 7 years. Mr. Secretary.
It is thrilling to know that tonight, hundreds of thousands of you, men and women from the farm, are taking part in a great anniversary celebration. Together with some of your friends in the cities and towns, you have assembled at dinner meetings in hundreds of counties, from the Atlantic to the Pacific, and from the Canadian border to the Gulf. You are celebrating the 7th anniversary of that day, March 8th, 1933, when President Roosevelt requested me as Secretary of Agriculture to call a conference of representative farmers and farm leaders to consider legislation for a national farm program. The conference was held 2 days later. Responding to the recommendations of the farmers, Congress established the first AAA. That act specifically recognized the right of the farmers of the United States to economic equality. And so these anniversary dinners tonight are being held in commemoration of the first decisive step toward writing into the law of the land the fundamental principles of agricultural justice. I am speaking to you from the President's study in the White House. In a few minutes, you will hear Postmaster General Farley and President Roosevelt himself. We want you to know how much we appreciate the splendid vision you have shown in holding these real farm dinners. For 7 years, you have been cooperating in an unprecedented effort. You are the men who have been fighting steadily for justice to agriculture ever since 1921. It has been hard work. Every struggle for human rights is hard. Some of you were born Republicans. Some of you were born Democrats. And some of you are independents. Some of you voted for La Follette in 1924. And some of you went down the line for Loudoun in 1928. And then turned to Al Smith. Nearly all of you joined together in 1932 and 1936 to support the greatest friend the farmer has ever had in the White House, Franklin D. Roosevelt. We do not yet have full agricultural justice, but we are much closer to it than we would have been without Roosevelt. In the decade of the 20s, we were feeling our way, trying to find some effective method of cooperating to combat the farm depression which had set in after the First World War. Farmers of the South and farmers of the West, long separated by differing views on the tariff, were trying to find a common ground for action. It was these efforts which finally culminated in national farm unity. And with the constructive and sympathetic help of the New Deal, in the first national farm program carried out for farmers and by farmers. The entire national farm program is a conservation program in the broadest sense. It conserves not only the soil, but also the best human values of farm homes and farm life. It is an all-weather, ever-normal granary and crop insurance program which is guarding both farmers and consumers against the dangers of drought as well as surplus. But this farm program goes still further. It helps to expand agriculture's markets abroad and at home. Through trade agreements and special export programs, farm exports have been increased. The American farmer doesn't like to be told that he shouldn't want anything but the American market. The trade agreements help him to regain his export market. At home, the Farm Program has established four great research laboratories to find new industrial uses for farm products. Another part of the program provides for getting farm surpluses to low-income families in the cities and towns. This is being done through direct purchase and distribution, and through the food stamp plan, school lunch program, low-cost milk program, and cotton stamp plan. Nor does the farm program stop there. It helps low-income farm families to help themselves. It helps tenant farmers to become owners. It brings electricity to farm homes. It meets the farmers' credit needs. All these phases of the farm program are vitally important. But perhaps the most important aspect of all, from the standpoint of farmers, is the nonpartisan farmer control, which has been a cardinal feature of the farm program from its beginning in 1933. No one knows better than the farmers what it is meant to have local operation of the program in the hands of men from the farm, elected by the farmers as officers of the county conservation associations and members of the community and county committees. The fact is, the farmers have helped to shape the farm program every year in the last 7 years. Today, the farmers of the United States are informed. They are thinking. They know where they stand and where they want to go. Working together with the government, they have built a great and valuable instrument through which they can achieve equality. During the last 7 years, the National Farm Program has had to contend with obstacles and hazards of every kind. It has met and conquered years of drought, years of surplus, and a heartbreaking adverse decision by the Supreme Court. It has survived bitter political attack and unscrupulous misrepresentation. Now it is faced with new problems brought on by the European war. In spite of all these obstacles and hazards, the farmer associations and farmer committees have carried on. And I feel sure that for many years in the future, they will continue as the stalwart champions of economic democracy on the farm. Tonight, let us look forward to completing the task of making the farm family secure in the marketplace, on the land, and in the home.
You have heard the Secretary of Agriculture, the Honorable Henry A. Wallace. Now, speaking from New York City, we present the Postmaster General, the Honorable James A. Farley.
President Roosevelt, Secretary Wallace, ladies and gentlemen, I consider it a privilege and an honor to be invited to speak to you tonight on the occasion of this farmer's anniversary celebration. Let us hope that the occasion may become an annual one, that it may grow into a national holiday worthy of the dignity of agriculture. First Monday in September is always set aside as Labor Day. Why should we not set aside the first Saturday or Monday in March as Farmer's Day? Secretary Wallace has talked to you about the farm program. My job has been to supervise the carrying of the mails. But I know from the experience of our post office department that something has been happening out on the farms in the years since 1933. The amount of mail addressed to and sent by persons on rural routes has increased substantially during that period. I would judge from the increase in the farmers' mail, and especially the number of parcels received by farmers, that they have more money to spend than they used to have. And so I'm not surprised when Secretary Wallace tells me that cash farm income for the nation as a whole has increased from $4.7 billion in 1932 to $8.5 billion in 1935, almost double what it was. Those are significant figures. When agriculture in any state is prosperous, that whole state is prosperous. The farmer's income from corn and hogs, from beef and grain and dairy products, soon finds its way into town. The entire station hums with life and activity. That activity is transmitted to the industrial centers and the financial centers. Even the stock market is affected by it, and investors all over the country share in the benefit. Because of the close relationship between farm prosperity and city prosperity, the cities have every reason to support an effective farm program. Unfortunately, some urban interests, journalistic, political, and financial, have been blind to this close relationship and have opposed nearly everything the farmers have tried to do. But on the other hand, many people in the cities have understandingly supported the farmers in their efforts for economic security and economic justice. I believe the farmers have special reason to feel kindly toward those urban representatives in Congress who have consistently voted for farm laws. After all, farmers constitute only 25% of the total population, and no farm program depending on government authority, or government funds can last long without the consent of at least some of the people in the cities and the towns. I myself have felt that the farm program is in the long-time interest of the cities themselves, and I have done what I could to spread an understanding of that fact among my city friends in Congress and elsewhere. I believe that one of the reasons why the farm program has commanded such strong and nearly universal support from the farmers is the fact that its administration has been kept out of politics. When the program was launched back in 1933, a fundamental decision had to be made. The President, the Secretary of Agriculture, and the majority in Congress had to choose whether to follow the old political tradition of using such a program for partisan advantage. The decision was made, and I believe it was made right, to keep the program out of politics. No farmer, regardless of his political affiliation, is barred from serving on the community and county committees which run the program. Years ago, the articles of the farmers' associations were so drawn as to prevent these associations from being used by committeemen or others for political purposes. We are proud of this record, which is a precedent in unselfish public service for either political party. Nevertheless, such public-spirited policies carry the danger that farmers may take the continuance of this program for granted, that they may pay little attention to the votes in Congress which keep it going, or to the views of the men and parties seeking office. These farm policies form one of the greatest developing issues of the nation. In this country, we hammer out such new ideas on the anvil of politics. It is the way of democracy. This farm program which you are fashioning will be the object of political attack and counterattack for many, many years. If it can outlive the onslaughts, the program will survive and become a part of our American way of doing things. The best evidence that farmers are on the alert to guard their program is found in these dinners tonight. This anniversary celebration of 7 years of achievement gives the nation hope the National Farm Program can and will be carried forward in the useful service of all the people.
Thank you, General Farley. We're back now in the White House. You've heard two cabinet officers thus far on this Farm Day broadcast, and now the nation's chief executive. Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
As I listen to the remarks of Henry Wallace and Jim Farley just now, and in my mind's eye saw the hundreds of groups of farmers and their friends meeting throughout the country, my memory went back to scenes of other years. I remember the day in September 1932 when at Topeka, Kansas, under the very hot sun, and my, it was a hot sun, that beat down on the steps of the state capitol, I talked with an audience of farmers about the farm problem. I gave them my pledge that if I were called to serve in the White House, I would take the lead in action. action to reverse the process of agricultural decay which had been eating at our national foundations for many years. And I have sought consistently and constantly to keep that pledge. 4 days after I took office in 1933, while the banks of the country were still closed and we were sternly wrestling with the question of how to get them open again, I called the Conference of Farmers and Leaders of Farm Organizations to which Secretary Wallace has referred. 7 years ago tonight, March 8, 1933, that call went out to farm leaders by wire and by telephone to come here and convene in Washington on March 10th. Well do I remember that historic conference at the White House that followed. In that grave emergency, past disagreements were forgotten, and all the farm groups quickly united on a new farm plan. The adoption of that plan in its essential outlines by the Congress marked a far-reaching decision in our national life. We stopped asking agriculture to pay the bill for industry's high tariff. We decided that as a nation, we would no longer promote commerce and industry at the expense of agriculture. We decided that as a nation, we would abandon the policy of rural neglect. That old policy of neglect had brought 10 years of depression on our farms and had contributed greatly to depression in the cities as well. It had hastened the bank panic, which in February and early March 1933 paralyzed business and industry and farming itself all over the United States. In the 7 years that have elapsed since that time, the National Farm Program has properly undergone a continual evolution. That first piece of legislation, the Agricultural Adjustment Act of 1933, was a long step forward, but of course it was not perfect. And as the years went by, weather conditions changed and market conditions changed, yes, and even court conditions changed. So the provisions of the farm program have been correspondingly changed to keep the program more up to date. We have learned from experience and have gradually adapted the program more and more closely to the needs of the individual farmer, to the needs of the nation, and to the needs of the land itself. We realized that we had reached our last frontier of new lands and that we had no choice but to conserve and rebuild our existing soil. All through these 7 years, one fundamental feature has run like a thread through the successive adjustment and conservation and ever-normal granary programs, and that is the essential policy of localized control, with the program run by committees of farmers elected by farmers. And that goes for farmers regardless of what party they happen to be enrolled in. Experience has amply borne out the wisdom of the safeguards with which those county associations and committees were surrounded. In 3,000 counties, practically all of the counties of the nation that are not occupied wholly by cities, they win respect. And incidentally, they deserve respect. None but those farmer committeemen themselves will ever know how they have sweated over details of the program, how they have sacrificed their own personal interests and their leisure as they spent thousands of hours and drove thousands of miles to make the program succeed. Back of these committeemen, helping them in their work, giving support to the program, have been some of the great general farm organizations. Not only in the farm communities, but right here in Washington, these organizations have helped to shape and perfect the successive farm laws. When we launched the National Farm Program 7 years ago, we hoped that recovery in the United States would be accompanied by a great revival of our trade with other countries. I wish I could tell you tonight that the whole world had been restored to prosperity and friendly commerce. I wish I could tell you that the markets which your fathers and grandfathers once enjoyed were again open to receive more of your wheat, your pork, your lard, your cotton, your tobacco, your fruit. I can tell you this, that we have done many things that have helped the situation. Through our reciprocal trade program, we have tried to spread our good neighbor philosophy through many nations of the world. I always prefer understatement to overstatement, and so I can properly say that that program has brought results. Results not only in better markets for our industrial goods, but also in better markets for our farm goods. Results which are mathematically proved in terms of pounds and in terms of bushels and in terms of dollars and cents. If Congress consents, we shall continue that useful work. But in spite of all we have done to help preserve and restore peace in the world, the bitter truth is that the world is not at peace. As I speak to you tonight, guns are thundering on the battlefields of Europe and of Asia. Ships that ply the seas are exposed to the hazards of bomb and torpedo. In the midst of a world at war, we find that the foreign commerce we had managed to achieve is rudely disturbed. Some people may say, what of that? Does not our domestic trade comprise 90% of all our business? Yes, that is true for the nation as a whole, but for some industries, export trade accounts for considerably more than 10% of all the sales. In agriculture, for example, that is true of cotton and tobacco and apples and lard and wheat and many other products. And all agriculture is certain to be seriously affected if our export markets disappear. So it is more than ever important for farmers to have a government in Washington that is looking out for their interests, not just by uttering glittering generalities, but by specific policies and concrete action. It is more than ever important to maintain a national farm program that can be adapted to meet whatever emergencies arise, whether they are emergencies of drought or of lost markets overseas. It is more than ever important to have a government in Washington that can act to protect the interests of our farmers as well as our businessmen when foreign trade conditions are upset. In Europe, economic failure has led in some lands to dictatorship. In America, we are using the tools of democracy to make our economic system efficient, to preserve our freedom, and to keep away even from any talk of dictatorship. The National Farm Program is American democracy's response to agricultural distress. And any unprejudiced person who knows anything about the subject not only admits but proclaims the fact that our National Farm Program was democratically conceived and is being democratically conducted with the active help of our farmers themselves. Furthermore, they proclaim what they know, that their federal government counts on farm aid and farm advice to improve that program through the process of actual experience as the need arises. That I call a truly democratic process of government. These are troubled times we of this generation are living through. Some of us I know are attempted to give way to doubt and fear, even to despair. But when we are beleaguered by thoughts like these, let us remember how the nation has come through its dark hours of the past and take courage. Think of John Adams and Jefferson and Madison as they guided the nation through the confusion and the wars of the Napoleonic period, with ships rotting at the docks, with millions of dollars of farm products stored on the wharves of the Atlantic seaboard. Think of Lincoln, as year after war-torn year, he sheltered in his great heart the truest aspirations of a country rent in twain. We believe our beloved United States will come through all its trials and tribulations of the present. Ever since 1929, the people of the United States have demonstrated pretty well the stuff of which they are made. One of the reasons we know we shall win through is the National Farm Program, the inception of which you are commemorating tonight. That farm program is a splendid example of what 6 million American families can do when they have the will and have the leadership to do it. The farmers have had a long, hard struggle to get laws and programs which give them an opportunity to obtain economic and social justice, to make it possible for them to conserve the good earth, which next to our people and our tradition of freedom is our greatest heritage. I am happy in the thought that American farmers have gone part way along that road to economic and social justice, even though they have not reached the goal. I am happy in the thought that American farmers understand full well that other great groups, such as industrial and retail groups in the cities, great and small, such as the small businessmen of the nation, have not yet attained the goal of social and economic justice, even though in these 7 years they have made undisputed progress toward it. Many years ago, I was told by men of experience in state and national affairs that American farmers could never agree on a program. I did not share that pessimistic belief. My friends and I went out to disprove it, and the farmers of America showed clearly that we were right. To them go the honor and the glory. In the spirit of progressive action that has animated and now animates these American farm families, all of us tonight can face with confidence whatever difficulties the future may hold.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have heard the President of the United States speaking from the White House in Washington. His address concludes this broadcast in observance of Farm Day, the anniversary of the issuance on March 8, 1933, of the President's call for the meeting of farm leaders which formulated the first of the series of programs of cooperative action which now make up the National Farm Program. Participating with the President in tonight's broadcast were Secretary of Agriculture Henry A. Wallace and the Postmaster General James A. Farley. This is the National Broadcasting Company.